have to be careful here since this is being recorded.
So, how do we start?
Hi, this is Aga and Łukasz, and this is Catching the Next Wave podcast, where we discuss the future of design.
And much more.
We have a fantastic guest today. I am super happy that we have an opportunity to talk to David Milen, a senior manager of design research at IBM Watson Health and an ACM Distinguished Scientist. David has worked at IBM Research for 20 years, a career that rarely happens these days. David was also part of IBM Research Brazil, working on projects regarding social data analytics, mobile microfinance applications, and multi-agent cognitive advisor for new investors. And before that, David worked at Bell Labs.
The Bell Labs.
Yeah, the most likely the first true industrial research institution ever. I've met David at a few ACM conferences back when I was a PhD student, and he made a totally lasting impression on you as well, Łukasz, right?
Yes, I had drinks with him.
Yeah. David, we are so honored to have you as our guest today.
So happy to be here. It's an honor to be invited to your podcast, which I had discovered a number of months ago and have listened to a number. We actually, in my workplace, have the equivalent of a book club, only with podcasts. And we call it PieCast because we also share a pie that somebody bakes. And we listen to various podcasts. And I would like to nominate one of your, maybe you could help me pick one of your podcasts to nominate to that particular group.
So wow. I've
been tracking you and your work and your podcast for some time.
This is unexpected. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
So I'm here in Rockport, Massachusetts, outside of Boston. And it is actually the 28th day that we have been under a shelter in place. So other than a walk outside to the beach, which is right nearby, I have not been out of my house in 28 days. It's a very historic time for the globe, for the world. But as of today in the United States, there are 547,000 cases of COVID-19 that have been diagnosed, and we have experienced over 35,000 deaths as a result of this terrible disease. So it's a very, very difficult and troubling time, and we're all, I think, reflecting on our families and kind of life in general. So I think it's an experience that we'll all look back on, and I'm not sure what we'll feel 5 years from now, 10 years from now, but we're living through it right now as we do this podcast.
So how do you see this affecting the immediate world around you?
Oh, it's changing everything. Certainly the way we interact with each other or don't. Almost everything has gone to virtual interaction online. Two big industries that I'm involved in, higher education. The Boston area is the home of many, many universities, and all of those shut down early, did the rest of their semester online. I'm actually scheduled to teach a class this fall at Tufts University, and it's likely that that will be done online as opposed to in the classroom. So there's a dramatic change in education. And then we're obviously also seeing significant changes in healthcare, which is my current focus, not only in terms of how it's delivered, but there's a sharp increase in the number of telemedicine, and a number of my colleagues have been hoping and waiting for that to take off. And maybe this is the catalyst that will make that happen. It's hard to know, but that would be good. It could change whole industries and the way we deliver the services that we do.
This is actually really interesting because telemedicine, e-health, all these topics have been discussed by research for decades, I would say, right? So it might be innovative or new for the world of consumers, of people starting to use these kind of things, but this is not a new topic when it comes to research, is it?
That's true. Distance learning, telemedicine, you're right. In our worlds of research, we have been experimenting with these literally for decades. And it might be that it's this global pandemic, this shock to how we live in the world that is going to create kind of the motivation, the catalyst for these changes. And what is unknown is whether or not these changes will stick. You know, there's certainly something about being in a classroom that online education just will never replicate. Likewise, there's certainly something about being in a doctor's office that's different at the other end of a screen. On the other hand, we might find that there are hybrid approaches that will really change the way these industries work. That might be one benefit of this terrible event we're going through.
Just on the topic of telemedicine, when we're having this podcast, we are using Zoom to communicate. And in the corner here, we have option to turn on original sound. Do you know, Aga, how it came to be?
Mm-hmm.
So this original sound, if you turn it on, the noise suppression kicks in and the echo cancellation. If it's off, it just signals straight through. That was meant for telemedicine.
Oh.
Zoom apparently was playing with someone. And I think it was something about the pulse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what kind of device it was. But that's the origin of this original sound in Zoom.
Oh. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, again, that's a form of natural innovation where something designed in one context jumps into another and finds a utility there. So that's great that that's happening. Actually, I had over 20 family members on Easter Sunday Zoom together from literally all over the United States. And that's something we had never done before. I've had old friends connect in similar way. I'm sure you have as well.
Yeah.
That could change the way we interact and use video just amongst our social relationships. And that's exciting in a good way, I think. Mm.
I'm also surprised that they called this isolation social distancing, while what actually happens is we have physical distancing. But socially, I mean, just the case you mentioned about the Easter meeting, it's actually many people tell us, and we also experience that we're actually closer socially with people that we have been in a loser contact before.
Yeah, I agree with that. It is an interesting use of the word because in many ways we are mediating our social interactions. We're accelerating those social interactions online. But I do think there's something fundamental and missing right now with the physical interaction, which is why many people are finding social distancing hard to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
There is something missing about just not being able to go to a restaurant. Even though we may not talk to the people because they're strangers, there's something about physically being in a shared space. There was a question that was asked of the governor of Massachusetts last week about when will they open up the stadiums? And sports is another big thing that's very popular in certainly the part of the US that I live in. And his response was essentially, that is so far down on my list of concerns that I can't even respond. And yet there is something that says that this kind of social interaction, it's fundamental. I think it's fundamental to human nature. We need that, and we're not experiencing that right now. And some of it's proximity, some of it's touch. Just being able to be near someone and shake hands. When I was in Brazil, the natural greeting includes all sorts of touching and kissing. And I can't imagine a culture where you suddenly say, we can't do that anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just very unnatural.
Actually, you know, like when this isolation started in Poland, I love to observe people, probably comes with the profession. So I've been observing people on the streets and people were passing by each other, not looking at each other. There was this feeling of averting the eyes, so there is no contact, like people were scared. And 2 or 3 weeks later, we were on a walk and I kept on trying to catch an eye to see how people react, whether they smile, whether they make the eye contact, whether they maintain the eye contact. And for 3 weeks, nothing of that kind happened. And suddenly, from 1 week to another, this has changed. So we went for a walk in our neighborhood. And suddenly I started noticing that people were looking at us. They were smiling. They were saying hello. And I was thinking like, yeah, probably this is exactly what you are talking about, that we want to be physically noticed, that we exist, that we are human beings and not only virtual beings. And that might have been a sign of it.
Oh, I've noticed exactly the same thing. One kind of additional observation is that we've all gone to a required use of masks. And so a very different feeling when I'm out with a baseball hat and a mask, and it's only the eyes. It's not the smile. And even the hello comes from behind a shielded mask. And again, it's very unnatural. I think we're getting used to that. But yeah, I've noticed a lot more hand waving and just acknowledgement of other people.
So like we've been talking just a moment ago, is that research talk about telemedicine for a long time now. And this is what often happens. The thing that often happens is that research starts thinking about different solutions before they actually hit the market, long before they hit the market. I think it was Bill Buxton who was talking about the long nose of innovation. I think that he was calling it like this.
Pretty much 10 years, right?
I'm not sure whether this was more a guess or an approximation or whether there was data behind it, but I kind of remember 10 to 20 years as a time frame for it. You've observed this phenomenon for so many years being in research and just seeing these things getting through research to the world of commerce. How do you see this happening?
One interesting path in my career was going from IBM Research in Cambridge and then in Sao Paulo. And when I came back to the US, I joined a design group in Watson Health. And so one is deeply, deeply into the technology. And there are so many problems to solve in artificial intelligence, algorithms, just many, many things to work on every day. The design perspective, and we've adopted quite fully a design thinking approach within IBM, is very much to hold back on the technology solutions first. So it's been a very interesting transition for me. To answer your question, though, design thinking is focusing on problem. It's a very, very user-centric view. It starts with that. And so you've got a problem. And then at some point in the process, there is an ability to merge a solution of some kind. And that inevitably involves some form of technology. It could be very lightweight technology, or it could be very deep technology. And the timing of those two, when we see an emerging problem and a technological solution that enables us to bring something either to the market or to the world, there's often an imbalance in that. You know, we've got a problem, we have no known solution, or of course, we've got many, many solutions that are sitting on the shelf oftentimes waiting for the right mix of a problem. And hopefully what we're observing with things like design thinking are ways to have better conversations, to find that match, to find ways to bring the problems and the solutions together in a more timely way.
I think that IBM Research might be one of the last industrial research institutions in the world today, right? We've been both connected to Philips Research. Łukasz had been working there for quite a few years, and it's kind of closing down. Other industrial researches, especially in Europe, they are also dwindling there. How does IBM manage to keep it up? And why do they keep it in the first place?
Having spent many years at Bell Labs and then in IBM Research, I've thought about this a lot. How do industrial research labs exist? The funding models has transitioned many times over the years. All the way from in the old Bell Labs, which was essentially a regulated monopoly. Bell Labs was part of AT&T, which was a regulated telecommunications monopoly in the United States. And they simply took some percentage of the total revenue stream and pushed that back into research. They had, I believe, the largest staff of PhD physicists on the globe at that time and doing some amazing material science research. Because that would find a path at some point into some fruition in this regulated monopoly. Well, Bell Labs is no longer part of a regulated monopoly, and it has transitioned dramatically. I've often said that that IBM, when the research division was being built, was in some sense a monopoly. In fact, there was a significant lawsuit with IBM about monopoly practices. And when you have that kind of a market share and that kind of an income stream, you have an ability to invest in basic research. In fact, I once heard somebody say, the problem is really a matter of choice. Where do you invest all of that income? And I would also then posit there are two other examples that I'm quite familiar with that are kind of monopolistic and have industrial research labs. Another one is Microsoft. You could argue that their Windows and their Office franchises have essentially dominated a market in such a way that their income streams on that are huge and they can continue to invest in a broad area of things. And then the more recent example from that is essentially Google, where they also have, I wouldn't call it a complete monopoly, but their search and the advertising revenue associated with search gives them a huge ongoing profit that allows them to invest. So part of my answer is that the industrial research labs kind of depends on the success and the market positioning of the company that they're funded from. And those are dynamic. Those are changing. They will continue to change. And as a company or a research lab like Bell Labs goes from, they're on two or three different companies now from when I worked there, the fortunes change and the investment changes. They still have a great set of researchers and still doing great work, but it's not the kind of incredible investment that they'd seen in the past. In terms of IBM research, they continue to evolve. Technology was listed as one of the top priorities by, we have a brand new CEO, and we are a tech company, have been, take great pride in patent leadership, which is a way of counting technology innovation. Not necessarily, you know, the most important metric, but it is one that's very visible. And IBM curates that very carefully and wants to be at the top of that and believes that there is a payback. Actually, since all the years that we've known each other, the IBM research has always had a mission to invest in technology that matters both for the company and the world, literally in, you know, the mission statement. And so there's a belief that it's not just complete blue sky technology. You've got to be able to say, I think it will matter here. It might end up, as we talked earlier about in the audio sense, it might end up being finding value in a totally different place. But there was kind of an initial inspiration, and that's still going on at IBM Research.
It makes me think of the overall strategic approach of IBM, because let's be honest, there have been ups and downs along the way since IBM was created. And somehow the company prevails. And actually, kind of, even if there is a moment when it's a little bit of a worse situation, kind of comes back with a new approach, transformation. How does it happen?
There's probably whole books that could be written about that. You are observing something that's very real. I wasn't at IBM during the early 80s, when the company went through some very, very significant hardships in the transition from the mainframe era of computing to when it all became PC-centric. Very big change. But the one thing I can say is that IBM is constantly monitoring those changes, constantly thinking very self-critically about how to respond to those changes, and then actually taking the risk to make those changes. One of the things that IBM Research does every year, this might have changed a little bit, but they create something called the Global Technology Outlook, a GTO. And that is one of the, call it a gift from the research division to, in effect, the chairman, to the CEO office. And it's a result of a collaborative year-long study of a whole wide range of technology opportunities and industry opportunities and trying to, not so much crystal ball, but a very plausible future as to where these investments should be made. And then, because it has very, very high visibility, there's always a next step, which is, okay, what are you going to do about it? If you identify these as the next six things, well, next year we're going to look at what happened on those. We track them year over year over year. And see, is occasionally we find that they're going as we expected, occasionally not so much. But then they'll make the change and they'll make the transitions. I've told people recently, and I think it's quite truthful, that we have become a cloud and AI company. I work for IBM, and we are a cloud and AI company. That's a very different company than I joined 20 years ago. And that's part of the transition we're talking about. I was describing to somebody how IBM took over most of the data centers in many of the large companies across the globe in the early 2000s. And that's because the data centers weren't the core competency of a company. So IBM took over the data, literally took the employees, took over the hardware, the software, and ran the data center. That was a total shift in the business for IBM, and they were multi-year, multi-billion dollar income streams. And IBM did that with great courage and great success. Kind of the next step of that was at some point, all of these physical data centers were all going to move to the cloud. So that was a natural evolution. IBM needed to see, well, how do we get there? We had our 100-year anniversary. Oh, it might have been 10 years ago already. Wow. And there was great introspection at that point about how does a company continue to adapt and stay healthy over the years. And part of it is by saying you're going to be in a different business and you're going to have to make very difficult decisions. I was at IBM when they sold off the ThinkPad division. I can still remember yes. My first ThinkPad. It was exciting. Mm-hmm. That was sold to Lenovo. Mm-hmm. And part because that part of the industry had become essentially commoditized. And it wasn't the kind of margins payback that IBM was looking for. So they divested that part of the business. It's making those hard decisions that is what they do.
I remember comments on the internet. People were really worried because those ThinkPads, they were really good quality.
Yeah, they were.
And there was a big question, will Lenovo keep it up or they will just turn the quality down, but I think they're still pretty decent.
Yeah, I think so. I have to admit, IBM transitioned to kind of more platform choice for our workstations. And I'm not unlike many IBMers. We shifted to Apple products. I'm quite happy with those at this point. You could ask the same question about a company like Apple or Microsoft. Their businesses are all morphing all the time and continually to be challenged. Apple's undergoing, I think, significant strain right now because, quite honestly, people are, you know, happy with what they have, and the iPhone replacement every year is just not happening. So they're looking for new growth opportunities as well.
You mentioned one thing that I would like to dig a little bit deeper into, which is risk and risk-taking, because this is the whole foundation for being innovative. You have to risk stuff. How is this risk-taking executed in a company like IBM?
Well, I'd have to say there's probably no one answer to that. It varies across different parts of the company. Certainly, a lot of discussion about corporate culture, and the culture has to be willing to accept risk-taking behavior, has to be able to deal with both celebrating successes, but also celebrating failures. And that's, in some ways, that's almost unnatural because, you know, we are very much trying to succeed and increase the number of successes. There's a story I tell about one of the projects that I managed in IBM Research. It was a early, fairly noteworthy project called Dog Ear, a social bookmarking. In fact, that's, I think, some work that I was discussing when I first met you, Aga, that social bookmarking within an enterprise setting. And the story was really, there was a designer and an engineer who gave just a briefing one day in our research group about this thing called Delicious, a social bookmarking application on the internet. And they looked at it and they said, this would really solve a problem that we have in our workplace, And yet we don't have anything like that that's protected behind a firewall that's enterprise grade, that I can bookmark things behind the firewall. And I remember saying to Jonathan Feinberg, the most amazing software engineer I've ever had the luck to know, I asked Jonathan, well, how long would it take you to build one of these? And he said, oh, maybe about 4 weeks. I could get a proof of concept up. I said, fine, go ahead. Essentially taking a risk. And 4 weeks later, I said to Jonathan, I said, so how's it going? And he looked at me and he said, you were serious? And I said, absolutely. And 4 weeks later, we had a proof of concept. 8 weeks later, we were deploying it within IBM. And then there's a whole other story about how it went from there to partnering with a product group and trying to find a path to market. And it wasn't all smooth, but it was about saying, it's worth the risk to try this. It's a relatively small investment. It continues to get bigger as we go forward, as you start to bring something to the marketplace. In fact, that's where the size of the risk gets really, really big. When we bring a new effect right now, we bring new AI products to the healthcare domain. It costs a lot of money to not only develop the underlying technology, but then to build the application and then to find a path to the marketplace. And quite honestly, not all of the products we've introduced in the past couple of years have been wild successes yet. But that's the kind of thing where we have to then bring them back in and say, well, what can we do to fix them? And occasionally, we had a very interesting, went beyond a proof of concept in the area of primary care. We were using our AI to essentially read patient notes. And one of the big problems that the primary care physicians have is they've got thousands and thousands of notes for every patient. And at each clinical meeting, they have to essentially digest that or make some sense of it. So we're introducing some of our AI technology in that. Have that up and running in several clinics, starting to get some really nice data. And essentially, IBM decided that there wasn't a particularly good path forward for the company market fit. And we ended up canceling that project. It was very painful. A couple of folks on my team were directly involved and very, very painful. But that's part of the risk-taking that we have to take. And sometimes we'll see, you know, we'll get it pretty far down the path and then make a decision. And this is just not quite going to be what we need. We need to divert and re-engage that group of people into something else.
You said that you bring products to the market, which sometimes not a huge success yet. And this yet is something that I really triggered on, because very often with business today, what happens is that they bring something to the market, they see that it's not working quite well and they kill it. They don't give it the time and the space to evolve, to improve and to change. Or on the other hand, they keep on tweaking constantly. Łukasz is like really annoyed with this these days. You know, A-B testing all the time, the solutions. So how do you improve on the product so that they become the success without the yet behind the phrase?
Again, no easy answer on that. Certainly, I believe in behavioral analytics through and through. Everything we ever built in my research team was fully instrumented. We constantly monitored what was going on, constantly looked for what was working and what needed to be changed. Part of it's timing, as we were talking earlier about things like telemedicine. If the market's not ready, if the workflow is not ready, if the environment where it's going to live is not ready, all of the pushing will not work, and that all of the tweaking will not work. It has to hit a need. It has to meet it almost immediately, in my opinion, and the value has to come back almost immediately. And then you have permission to continue to tweak it. But if you don't have that immediacy of something valuable, you might not get the chance to continue to tweak it. So that's really important.
There's another thing that you started talking about, which is value. And that kind of comes back to the mission that IBM has, bringing something that changes the world, that brings value to the world. There is this strategy of many companies to focus on the profit and the value for stakeholders. How do you see the opportunities for being innovative in this kind of setup versus the setup that you have at IBM?
This is something that's probably best articulated in some of the design thinking frameworks. If you're not solving a real user problem, you're not going to get what we've always called in social computing. You're not going to get the social engagement. You're not going to get, very early on, it was clear that what makes a social network application work is engagement. You have to have that engagement. We were constantly looking at what drives that engagement. But in almost every product, there has to be some value that is exchanged with the end users. And by the way, the end user, oftentimes we think of that just as the person who's touching the software or touching the device. But oftentimes it needs to include, again, design thinking talks about stakeholders. It might actually be that person's boss, or it might be the chief financial officer who's has a say in bringing the system. There has to be value created to them for the product to actually succeed. If that doesn't happen, profitability won't ever happen. You know, they'll basically stop using the product. They won't renew licenses. They won't buy a second or third time. Profitability will never happen. In fact, I went back and looked at, I think I might have been alerted to this on LinkedIn. I saw your seed cards.
Yeah.
I went back and looked at some of those this morning. And that's very much solving a problem of, here is a problem. And I looked at, you know, every one of them, said, yeah, that's a real problem. Mm-hmm. And if you can solve that problem, and there's oftentimes an infinite number of ways you can solve that problem. We have a lot of creative people in the world. It's just, let's figure out an interesting problem and then go to work on that. So sometimes that's where we run amok in introducing, you know, products to the marketplace that just aren't solving the genuine need. It's pretty basic, but it does happen.
I would like to ask about a related aspect, and it has to do with this constant tweaking. My current pet peeve is with Spotify. But let me phrase it as a question. When is the natural moment in the life cycle of a product to stop innovating on it?
It is a really big challenge in many, many product domains. I think the folks, and I know several at Spotify, would argue that they are continuing to evolve the product to meet user needs. They published last year or so an interesting set of search studies where they're trying to understand when people are trying to find something on Spotify. It's not always a song. Sometimes it's a song. Sometimes it's a lyric. Sometimes it's a artist. And those are always very distinct search activities. Mm-hmm. If you understand that that's what's going on, then you can ask yourself, well, can we tweak the interface, the experience, in a way that helps solve that problem? To your point, as we add more and more solutions, we can occasionally obfuscate the value that was there front and center early on. And that is a problem. Actually, I have seen products that go with kind of a two-tier strategy where they have a basic model. Apple has done that with their iPhones, where they try to have kind of a basic, less featured model and a fully featured and a dual product market strategy where you might have just the essence in an initial one. But by and large, most product companies, I think, are trying to continue to find new problems and then find new solutions, which means the tweaking you're talking about continues to happen. In fact, I was trying to outline a little bit about what I had learned about what makes social networking software work. And part of it is the constant algorithmic tweaking. Mm-hmm. So what you see on Facebook changes year over year because what you've been doing changes year over year, as does all of your connections and what they're doing. So it's trying to evolve in a dynamic space. The same would be true with Spotify. Your musical tastes probably change over time, and they're trying to capture some of that so that they can help follow that for you and present better things for you. But that dynamic algorithmic updating is something that's built into at least all of the personalized social applications that are out there.
I think your Spotify friends should thank you, because now you made me think wider about this product. And I must say that the discoverability, whatever.
Discoverability, yeah.
So whenever I'm looking for something, you know, related or unrelated to my tastes and how they present their choices based on my past behavior, that's really good. Where I'm getting lost often is when they radically change the UI stuff, I think. So my pet peeve is actually if the UI people. So I will cut them a little bit more slack than I was ready to do this morning. I was really on the verge of, let's try one of their competitors.
But... Well, there is kind of the importance or the power of habit. That's why when we talk about integrating within a given workflow in the healthcare field, we're not just designing a new standalone application. It is going to work in the context of a half a dozen other applications. And we have to understand that. And occasionally we haven't been sensitive enough to some of that.
That brings me to a question of where do you see the difference between academic research, industrial research, and innovation today?
That is a very good question. Academic versus industrial lab research and innovation. And I have had these conversations many times with interns in our lab who are often trying to figure out, do I go into academia or do I go into industry? That's a very clear choice as one completes graduate program. And they often tell me that they feel they'll have more freedom of choice in terms of research projects or research areas in academia. So one, you might say that there's more flexibility in topics, but I would argue that's kind of a false reality. I have sat as an industrial member on National Science Foundation review panels where we're essentially making decisions about who gets NSF awards. And those are very much calls for research in a particular domain. So those are very much constrained, much like we get a problem space in an industrial lab. So my argument is that there's always going to be competition or scarcity of resources. So I don't think there's much difference there. There may be some. There is always some kind of a motivating or guidance in terms of the scope of the work. I would say one of the big differences is this is a big difference. Industry often has the investment to do larger projects for longer periods of time. Mm-hmm. That's very much on the minds of IBM research managers. We want to solve problems that are really hard to solve in clusters of one or two people, or even a consortium of three academic departments. We want to solve something that might require 100 researchers on it, where we had the Jeopardy project doing some fundamental AI research, probably had on the order of 100 people involved in it and lasted many years. So that's the kind of thing that industrial labs can afford to do. Now, again, are there examples outside of industry where that's being done? Certain government projects like some of the space programs are multi-year programs. There's certainly some academic consortiums that are large and big. The profit motive, you might have expected that as an answer, but increasingly I'm seeing academia aware of the potential for profitability as well. IBM Research in Cambridge is just down the street from MIT and Harvard, and oftentimes we found a little tension in working through intellectual property agreements, in part because that's what holds the constraints on the future go-to-market or profitability of these things. It can be overcome. And one answer to your question is, in some cases, there's very little difference between the kinds of research because we're working together. There's a big IBM MIT AI lab in Cambridge right now. There's a new building being built. IBM Research is going to have one of the floors. It's over on the MIT campus. So there are many, many places where we're working more closely together.
So you're talking about industrial research and academic research, but different companies all around the world, like banks and insurance companies, telecoms, you know, all the big institutions everywhere are trying to be innovative as well. And they don't meet industrial research. They build innovation labs. How would you compare or differentiate between what IBM research is doing versus these innovation labs?
That's an important question. And I've actually had experience in two different industries with exactly that. When I was in Brazil, we were doing some work with microfinance and working with one of the banks in the northeast of Brazil. It's clear they had their own innovation projects going on, their own proof of concept projects going on. I would say one key difference between what we were doing and what they were doing, and we were doing things together, but the things that they were doing by themselves are much more focused, much more targeted on things that they know to be problems. They're just looking for, well, they're all looking for innovation. This particular bank approached IBM because they were unable to continue building bricks and mortar banks. They just made no more sense to expand on those across Brazil. So they were trying to understand what were some of the potential solutions, which is why we were doing a project in microfinance, which are these community-backed lending programs that are very, very different. Again, the problem is how to find a solution that is interesting to IBM and interesting to the bank. But the bank's own innovation group could take it pretty far, and maybe they're the ones that will take it to market ultimately. There's a lot of examples of these innovation departments or groups in hospitals. In fact, one of the design researchers at IBM had done work at Sloan Kettering. Another one had done work in one of these groups at Mayo, the Mayo Clinic in the Midwest. And they're looking very carefully at breakthrough. And in some respects, I would say they've got an advantage over some of the industrial labs. Why? Because they've got the context. Mm-hmm. They've got the problems in terms of the patients, the actual disease cases. They've got the domain experts, all of the medical practitioners, all the way from the PhD, MD surgeons down to all of the staff that helps every other part of the hospitals. They've got all of those, and they know those workflows in and out. So again, I believe it's the great place for innovation in those large companies. Again, where they don't have some of the advantages that industrial lab might have is the depth of technology. For example, they wouldn't have the kind of fundamental research in AI that IBM is doing, or Google, or Microsoft, which is why these kinds of hospitals are partnering with Google and Microsoft and IBM. So yeah, I think you're on to probably a very general insight that there's going to be a lot more partnerships where this innovation is going to take place that is going to go outside of the industrial labs or the academic world. It's going to involve the industry innovation departments, the industrial research labs, and academia working together. But as you know, we often come together anyway in our research spaces. So you can go to a top-tier conference or do a workshop and have conversations with people that are in any one of these different domains. And that's where some of these ideas are shared and incubated and spawned. So I was having a discussion with an IBM researcher recently about, will workshops, scientific workshops, change as a result of this pandemic? And one of the things that's very easy to do for our big conferences is to take the workshop programs and just do those virtually. And if that becomes easy to do, why aren't we doing those all the time?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we taking a topic of mutual interest to interesting people throughout the globe and finding a very easy way to get together for a day to exchange what we know? A lot of different ways to do that, but now mediated and do it with much more regularity. That would be really exciting if we could really do that more often.
Absolutely.
As I was thinking about this conversation, I went back and looked at Stephen Johnson's book, Where Do Good Ideas Come From? And our paths have crossed periodically. Probably the last time was a number of years ago at a social computing conference. And the social computing conference had to do with cities. And he writes a lot about cities and a lot about where innovation takes place, because cities provide the natural incubation of ideas. It's also scary that Stephen Johnson has also written about pandemics, because that's the other thing that incubates in cities. But ideas incubate in cities and in social interaction, on social networks, and it can be overwhelming, but it's that flood of ideas that is quite interesting. It's where I think a lot of the new ideas are going to come from. There was one story that I wanted to share with you that I was thinking about. Have you heard about a young Boy Scout named Quinn Callender from Canada?
It rings a bell.
He has solved a problem having to do with the masks that are being worn in the ER rooms. He had become aware of the facial bruising that can happen with these masks, which, by the way, is very real. I saw my niece, who had just done a shift, with a Band-Aid on her nose because of a wound that was created from all of the equipment she was wearing. And so anyhow, he was interested in 3D printing. And he had found an example of a band that would connect and relieve the pressure of these masks that he could create on 3D printing. But the interesting part of the story is his mother posted a story of him in his Boy Scout uniform with a picture of these devices on Facebook. A 500,000 shares later and countless press articles later, people are aware of this solution. So then you actually, what you find out if you follow the article is that there is a do-it-yourself, a maker site for 3D printing, that the original version of this, that Quinn had found the original version of this, that was actually adapted from a design that was created by a person in Hong Kong. So now we have a solution to a problem coming first to Hong Kong, quickly to 3D printer in the U.S. being captured by a young Boy Scout and then going viral with a mother on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And it's the combination of all of that. It's the accelerators of things like buttons and getting into people's feeds through a lot of these social computing. These are the things that didn't exist in cities 100 years ago, these accelerators or these filters of ideas. And so when we do feel overwhelmed, there are ways where we can go and where some of this does get filtered and we get pointers to not always the best answer, but one that works and one that we can take action on. What's really great about this particular device is it's essentially being offered through Creative Commons. Anyone can download it and print them. It's a form of open sourcing a design, which is really, you know, a whole different form of innovation support. Getting it out, helping it go viral.
Yeah.
I think this is what your cousin is printing in her basement, right?
Yes. That's true.
I'm optimistic that some of these technologies will really help us innovate. I wouldn't be fair if I didn't say that one of the things that I think the social computing researchers were a little bit blindsided by was, as much as they can accelerate many, many good things, the things that have been accelerated with fake news are also possible. And so we've got to find the balance and in a way to accelerate the good things for society and hopefully dampen those that are not.
This is actually something that I've been also thinking about, that as researchers, we tend to be overly optimistic about how technology is going to be used. I've never seen a story of a negative technology usage in any of our conferences. This is a bit of an idealistic blindness.
That's a true statement. In fact, we even use words that appropriation is taking a technology and using it in another way, but in some cases, it could be used for good and other cases used for the opposite. But you're right, we don't talk as much about that. I remember a project that one of my colleagues who I know you know, Wendy Kellogg, was involved in. They were doing these very, very large scale conversations called jams at IBM. And the very first one they did, I think it was over 100,000 IBMers participated in this 48-hour conversation. They had put all sorts of safeguards in place in case the conversation went off the rails in some way. And they found out that they didn't need to do that. Now, again, that what's interesting on that is that there may be governance protocols in place within an institution that prevent that kind of behavior that aren't in place outside. And there are fairly loose governance policies in place in other parts of the social web. And so we get very extreme or very varied behaviors. But some of that can be done with moderation. Actually, there have been papers having to do with moderation in social spaces. And that, I think, is to try to direct both good behavior, but also bad behavior. I agree. Researchers, by and large, are very optimistic, I think.
Yeah. And also, this is the quintessence of optimism bias, right? Because yes, we want to solve the wicked problems, therefore we see the possibility of the solution in an optimistic way, and we also see the impact of the solution in an optimistic way. And there we go.
I seem to remember when they were firing up the Large Hadron Collider,
yeah, I was in Zurich at the time, yeah.
I'm not sure whether this was true or myth, but apparently there was a tiny chance that a microscopic
black hole
will open. And I just wonder what the chances were that small, or that hole was supposed to be really tiny, or the physicist just said, yeah, let's turn this key anyway.
Well, now we're kind of circling back to questions of risk. You know, what kind of risk for some of the unknowns are we willing to take? And a financial risk in terms of a new product in the grand scheme of things is not very important. The risk is that the world's evaluating right now about going back to work or exposing people to a deadly virus, those have very, very serious consequences and no easy answer. And that's why there's so much discussion and debate right now on these topics.
What are the things that stimulate innovation?
There's no recipe, although people write books about innovation all the time with recipes in them. Design thinking is a framework with a bunch of recipes in it for innovation. In my opinion, it kind of comes back to why I was always interested in social interaction and social engagement. I think innovation is a result of a mix of ideas. And so creating an environment where you'd have a mix of ideas. By the way, that's where multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary thinking comes in. You really want groups of people who don't all think the same way. So that's really important. I remember there was a slide, a graphic that I've used that was created by Ron Burt having to do with small team performance. And the optimal configuration recipe, as you might say, for a innovative small team is a small cluster of people that have a lot in common, a common vocabulary, a common knowledge base. That's important because they need to be able to talk about the problems in a similar way and evaluate them and from a common ground. But beyond that, it's each one of the people inside this common cluster has links or a network outside of this cluster that don't overlap with each other. So they have relationships outside that know different things that they can tap and bring in new information into the core. So that's about, if you were to try to mastermind an innovative environment, you want to have an environment with a strong culture, but the ability to bring in very divergent views. That's why things like intern programs or visiting faculty programs or conferences, it's all about mixing ideas so that you create innovation spaces. And I think the scientific world has known that to be true for a long, long time and know how to do that. Beyond that, I think there needs to be a really good set of problems, and articulating those problems is highly motivational. You know, clearly the problem of getting a person to the moon was highly motivational in the U.S. space program in the 1960s, a real strong problem. Having resources is important. You've got to have, if you're going to do a super collider, that's not a small investment. You've got to be able to do, in that case, big science. You have to have an aptitude for failure. You've got to be able to try things out, and if it doesn't work, try something else out. Very early on in my Bell Labs days, we did a field trip to the Thomas Edison Museum in Edison, New Jersey. And the story of how the development of the filament for light bulbs was made clear. And it was essentially not a theoretical grounding. It was try every possible filament you can find. try. And thousands of failures later, one worked. It's a different model of innovation, but it's one that absorbs failure and rapidly looks for success. Maybe one last item. My sense is that you need really talented people, talented minds. And there's no shortage of those in the world. Everyone's born with the ability to be one. But I think being able to attract and cultivate really talented people is important. Being able to nurture, and this is part of the what we do in the labs I've been at. We try to bring in people and find what they're interested in and what they're good at and help them excel. There are ways we can celebrate and help people achieve their stardom, their innovation success.
What really makes me curious, you mentioned a number of times already design thinking, which we used to call the user-centered design. Do you see a difference there?
Yes, I would completely agree. There's a huge amount of overlap. There is a difference in that design thinking has branded and marketed largely through IDEO and various design schools. And they've made an approach accessible to a very broad audience in a way that user-centered design was unable to do. And so I'm actually grateful to design thinking for that burst of energy and that ability to make it much broader. But yeah, the whole first third of the class that we'll be teaching this fall is techniques in early user research, user-centered design research that are literally textbook decades old. We can tweak them a little bit and make them better, but they've been around for a long time. And rapid prototyping, not new. User feedback during rapid prototyping, not new. But institutionalizing that across a multidisciplinary team within a business, that's really powerful. And so all of the surround that goes with that is important. Kudos and thanks to Don Norman, who did a lot of, I think, a lot of that same kind of work early on. You have to remember the initial version of the book was The Psychology of Everyday Things, which was then rebranded to The Design of Everyday Things. But I still have the original book. That's about branding. That's about reaching a broader audience. And that's good. I think having impact on the world in that way is partly how you package the communication.
Yeah.
And design thinking has definitely done a good job of that.
When I look at design thinking versus user-centered design, from business perspective, I can see that the broadly understood user-centered design is adopted by designers working with technology. And design thinking is something that is better understood by business. And I think that right now, people who come from the user-centered design look down a little bit on design thinking, saying, yeah, this is like the simplified version of the design process. But I think that this is a very necessary evolutionary step for design to actually be seen as a tool for creating meaningful innovation. So not only creating innovation, you know, meaning an offer from business or technology from the technological side, but bridging these two things together to solve problems that I hope that they will go beyond humans, beyond people, and start looking at the bigger problems that we are facing today.
I really appreciate those thoughts. It's interesting that my introduction to design thinking was largely through design-trained designers, a lot of them in service design trained, which is not as technology centric, you know, very much about how people move through banks or various other kinds of service offerings. And I agree, a lot of the user-centered design grew out of a lot of the technology-based, the human factors world, where I initially grew out of in Bell Labs with all of the hardware and integration of software. So that is an interesting bridge. Interesting to point out, the class that I'm teaching this fall, Innovation and Design Thinking, is in a mechanical engineering department.
Wow.
And I was particularly interested in seeing how I would adapt, or how we would need to adapt, design thinking for very technology-centric students who will probably jump to building something on day one. You know, the maker part of that is no problem, but trying to match that with a real problem is going to be a bit of the challenge. So that was part of what intrigued me. You know, let you know in 6 months how it turned out. Part of these frameworks like design thinking are actually giving tools to help expand our way of asking questions, even our way of understanding the answers to those questions. And sometimes it's just that extra framework that helps us not fall back to our biases.
Yeah.
It's that little extra nudge. I did some work on scenario planning in Bell Labs, and we worked with a global business network. They have a whole set of techniques. Again, many of those, I would say, overlap with some of the design thinking techniques. But the one thing that they had that I want to bring to this conversation is the notion that bringing in what they would call remarkable people into the workshop was a requirement. So we did a workshop where we were talking about, again, this was, I think, futurist cities. And we brought Jaron Lanier of 3D Spaces and Virtual World fame. We brought him into the room because we knew he would think about these problems in a totally different way. And it's that bringing in these unusual, remarkable, very different from us kinds of people. And so that might have been, those kind of techniques are what we need to bring to young engineers to help them see it from a different perspective.
So you already mentioned that at Bell Labs and also at IBM, there were or are attempts to predict the future somehow. What is the value of that exercise?
Well, it's actually consistent with a fairly big and popular push right now on design fictions. The reason that the Global Business Network would advocate doing future thinking is that it helps you rehearse future scenarios, rehearse them in your mind so that partly when you see them, you're not seeing them for the first time. You've already thought through some of them. Inevitably, you'll get the future wrong. In fact, all of these techniques involve multiple futures. You know that you can't do one. You've got to do many. And the reason you do many is so that you can think through what are some of the variants that are out there. It's a creative exercise. It helps you expand the way that we think about problems. But at the same time, I would have to say, I am a little cautious in my use or advocacy of that kind of thinking. I've observed in various design thinking workshops that we have been able to come up with a number of solutions to a problem that are just not actionable. They seem actionable in the confines of a small workshop with a group of people. We would all like to travel in time, and we think that a time machine would be a good thing to build. Well, that's true, but we don't know how to do that right now. And this is particularly true with when we bring into AI technologies into some of our solutions. There are just some things that at the moment we can't do. And that's where this future thinking gives us a false sense of security. And unfortunately, that means we can also expend a fair amount of time going down a path that it's not, this goes back to our timing question we've talked about. The timing's not right we can't do it yet. So it's good to know that if we could do that in 2, 3, 5 years, it would be a great thing to do. That's nice if we could track that somewhere. So that some of my thoughts about design fiction and scenario planning.
When I look at these workshops, and I've been invited to participate or to run quite a few of them, I always have an impression that the results seem to be the optimistic, abstracted version of what's going on today put into the future. So they are not very different. They are actually quite incremental. Together with a friend of mine, with Pim, who was on the podcast in the last season, we did something which we called a radical design workshop, which was a very interesting exercise in a sense that we got the students. It was the industrial design department at the Delft University of Technology. We took them for time travel 50 years into the future. So it's like this huge distance that you can't really imagine that it's going to be directly related to the present. And basically the whole thing was that they were asking us questions and we were giving them silly answers. The only rule in the answers was that they had nothing to do with the current situation. So if they ask us like, what do you eat in 50 years? We would say like, yeah, do you remember the pasta tree? Or if they ask us, okay, like, so do you have a romantic relationship? And we say like, with cats? So, you know, like just provoking the students to break all the stereotypes of how things are today and make them think in a radically different way. It was actually quite interesting because that was the only workshop I participated in or I ran where the results that we've got at the end, they had no link to how the present solutions are.
I really like that. There is a notion of breaking the mold, the thinking that you have. Oftentimes, designers and my wife, who's an artist, they use inspirational objects. And that's why travel is so outrageously helpful in innovation, is that you see things that are just very different. And they get you thinking about different uses and why are they different and how did they come to be. And there, again, are, I wouldn't say recipes, but there are techniques that we can use, mood boards and things that designers are very familiar with to help you start thinking about this problem in a very different way. So I agree, to get you into a creative space, those are very, very helpful, very useful.
Yeah.
I had a discussion recently with a financial analyst about what's going on in the current world. And it was clear to me that he thought about this pandemic as just another financial shock. Mm. And financial analysts think about financial shocks all the time. And my question to him was, this seems pretty unique to me. It has certainly never occurred in my lifetime, and the last pandemic of this magnitude was over 100 years ago. And with shutting down of the global economy, I don't know that it is just another financial shock. But this kind of goes to, how would you have imagined something like this? If we had one magic wish, what would that be that would revert everything back? I mean, clearly a cure or a vaccine might be the magic wish, but I'm not sure even at this point that the entire global economy is going to revert. We've talked about ways that it might actually evolve or mutate, hopefully in ways that might be really good. But you know, these are interesting innovation exercises and techniques. Where they get a little scary is that we're kind of living through one of these at the moment. I've been reading, I'm sure you have, about the world 2 years from now. That's a future scenario activity, but it's not a workshop. It's for real.
Yeah, exactly.
And we all have a pretty strong vested interest in the outcome. And we all don't know. We don't know.
Actually, with all these scenarios thinking, this pandemic has been called the Black Swan, from what Nicholas Taleb was talking about. But actually, Dave Snowden, he called it very interestingly a black elephant rather than a black swan. So he said, it's not like we didn't know that this thing could happen eventually, but we just didn't want to see it. And again, this is a bit of a problem with future scenario thinking, that somehow we don't want to see the hard truths that we should face, that somehow climate change, all these big topics that have been discussed since forever, are still not on the agenda. And I'm curious whether the way of approaching future scenario creation is going to be impacted by the fact that we are actually having this black elephant being among us and saying, hey, you know, things that we thought couldn't have been possible.
Not on our watch, at least.
Yeah, not on our watch. They actually happen.
That's interesting, the black elephant analogy. And I think there's some truth to that. Some things I've read are that maybe we will take global warming and global science more seriously, another black elephant in the room post-pandemic. Part of this, I think, also is human nature, not to want to spend a lot of time on the really, really difficult circumstances. Part of it's our inability to understand. We had Jonathan Gruden from Microsoft give a talk in Cambridge a number of years ago. And I don't think he's ever published it, but he was actually trying to convince the audience that humans are really, really bad at sensing and understanding exponential curves. We don't see it. And by the time we finally get it, it's too late on the curve. And that's exactly what's been going on with this pandemic. So it might be one of these things that we've got epidemiologists who've been thinking about this for a long time, but to everyone else, they just don't really internalize it, understand it, really, and certainly the long-term implications. The idea that a pandemic like this would result in this kind of economic shutdown certainly never occurred to me.
No.
And how it will result in jumpstarting things back to normal. I don't know.
So if you were to look at the innovation around you in the last days, weeks, months, years, what was the thing that was a big positive surprise for you? Something that's like, oh, that was really an awesome innovation.
Well, in some ways, that's an easy one for me, although it's not just very, very recent. I was an online community researcher for many years, very intrigued about some of the early even text-based listservs, news groups, CompuServe, the fact that people would come online and talk to each other to solve problems, to be social. And clearly it was a low-tech environment. And after many years of studying that with a number of other community researchers, some of whom we know together, something happened. It wasn't all just Facebook, but I'll use Facebook as the example. Here again, the magic sauce of a rich personal profile, the embedding of a social graph, and the ability to move around in that social graph, in the information spaces created, and navigate that through the social graph, was what happened in MySpace and Facebook. And that, to me, changed the way we interact online forever. And quite honestly, that's fairly recent, 15 years maybe, that we've had that capability. It's permeated our makerspaces and our music spaces. And it's everywhere. It's that ability to create public rich profiles, the social graph. I've often wondered whether the folks, these early startups, whether they really understood that this was what made it work. And in some ways, I think maybe they did because, you know, managing the social graph, there are many, many capabilities of those in LinkedIn and Facebook. But that's really the heart of what makes for that experience. The other thing that I've often said is that because it's based on a social graph and the algorithms, by the way, that get attached to that, that's another big accelerator of that, make it such that my experience on Facebook is unique. Why? My social graph is unique, unless you had exactly the same social graph as me, which makes every one of the billions of people that use Facebook have a unique experience. That, to me, is a unique online experience. So again, the power of what has been afforded through the Facebook and social platforms in general is the innovation that I think has changed, in most part for the good, has changed the world.
If you were to recommend a book that inspires people to be innovative, what would it be?
That's a tricky one. I would probably come up with multiple, but for the short term, I think I'll go with Stephen Johnson's Where Do Good Ideas Come From? If you were to read it, it's got a good breadth of material in there. And a lot of what he writes, I would put in the same space. There are clues to how innovation works, and it's consistent with my worldview of it's all about the mix and the creating or cultivating ways of mixing people and ideas. That's where the magic's going to happen.
David, thank you for this conversation.
Yeah, thank both of you. This has been very, very enjoyable.
It's been a
lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Catching the Next Wave podcast. We would love to hear from you on Twitter at Malka6 and at DLS6. You can find more details on www.catchingthenextwavepodcast.com.